My name is Dawn, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I'm checking my watch. I hope I remember what time I start. So, if my kids were in the audience, they would start going like this. I want to thank Marilyn for asking me to come here and share the good news of recovery. I want to thank Art and Sarah for being so kind to me this weekend. I really appreciate that. I want to thank all of you for being friendly and letting me know that this is a family, and that's what it is. This is the family I always wanted, and I found it in these rooms. And so I don't come here like I'm talking to strangers. I come here like we really do know one another, and that's the good news. Some of the people in the program know they know me better than my own family knows me. Not better than my children or my husband, because they've lived with me. I say that with and when I say that, sometimes they say, yeah, we live with her. But they've seen the good part and they've seen the sick part, and I'm so grateful that there have been more years of my healthy beginnings than the old days. I really am an old-timer in the program. I'm an old-timer. Used to be when I'd go to meetings, my husband and I would be the youngest ones there, you know. And how the years do change. It's interesting to see people have now begun to help Peter and I to our chairs. You know? They kind of look like, well, we like them here, but they're really, you know, things are missing up here now, you know. And they probably are, because my memory is about this short, you know. But that's okay. That's okay. I remember one of my sponsees asked me the other day, how do you become a speaker in a program? And I said, well, you have to reach the age where you forget everything. And then, you know, they ask you to become a speaker so that you'll never forget your story. And therefore, you won't go away. You will keep coming back. You know, you just cannot go away. And the more I hear my story, the more I realize that I need these programs as much. I need this program as much today as I needed it 38 years ago when I walked in the door. I think I need it more now. I go to at least 4 or 5 meetings a week when I'm in town, when I'm not going to be away on the weekend. And I need those meetings. I had an experience not long ago, which I really enjoyed. I've been away on weekends for about 6 or 7 weekends in a row. And I went to my home group, which happens to be a Saturday meeting. So I have to do other meetings during the week when I'm going on traveling or something. So I got to this meeting, and this young woman came up to me, and she said, are you new? And I said, no, I've been coming for some time. And she said, you have? She said, well, I've just been here 4 weeks. And she said, I just came up to welcome you. She said, how long have you been here? And I said, 38 years. And she said, you really were sick. I couldn't argue with her on that one. I'm grateful to be here. You know, I used to like to start my story when I met the alcoholic, and it certainly didn't make me look good. I like that. I was Miss Wonderful, you know, and then I met this alcoholic, and it was downhill all the way, you know. And I really liked that, but it wasn't the truth. I went to, had to take our youngest child to a psychiatrist I guess it was some 20-something years ago, and he was having a hard time getting his life together. He was really just so troubled, and the psychiatrist wanted to talk to my husband and myself, and she said, I want to know, I'm talking to my husband, what kind of parenting did you receive on a scale of 1 to 10? And my husband said, I received about a 0 or a 1. And she looked at me and she said, what kind of parenting did you receive on a scale of 1 to 10? And I said, I received an 8 or a 9. And she said, no way in the world would someone who received an 8 or 9 marry someone who received a 0 or a 1. Well, that certainly burst my balloon, you know. I mean, I've always had this ideal thing of my family and his family. You know, my family looked good. We've always looked good. My father In the beginning, let me start my story. I grew up in a parsonage. I was born in Flint, Michigan, and we moved to Detroit when I was a year old, and my father had this church that had about 300 members when he got there, and by the time he left, there was something like 5,000 or 6,000 members. My father was an eloquent preacher, eloquent preacher. I would sit at the feet of my father any time to listen to him preach, unless he was preaching at me. That was different. To hear him preach was just a magnificent thing. You know, he just was so gifted. And into this family, my mother had 8 children. When you're in the Methodist church, you can't play cards. You can't dance. And so my mother and father had 8 babies, you know, in the class. My father would build a church and my mother would have a baby, you know, it was like that. So by the time I came along, they decided to buy the next church. So I was the last of these 8 children. My mother lost 3 children along the way, and I don't know what that was like for her. You know, I mean, I know it was a very painful time in her life, but she never talked about it much. And what she did was kind of stay a little distance from us. She used to say, "I never liked children anyway. You know, it was just something that happened, you know." And so she wasn't what you call, like, the baking mama. You know, she did a lot of nice stuff with us, but she didn't really like kids. I mean, she was... When you have 5 children in the house at a given time, and we have our friends in the house, like, she had enough of children. And then they had to work at the church with the other children in the church. And it was always something going on. And our house was unusual. We were noisy, exuberant children. You know, people used to say at the church, they're just bad children. And I never went along with that. My mother didn't go along with that. She said we were just interesting children. We, you know, always had a different way of doing something, you know. And we used to do things like on Sunday morning, before my father would preach these eloquent sermons, the janitor of the church, which I've always felt was extremely stupid, would go down to make a call to his wife on a Sunday morning, every Sunday, in the same telephone booth. And every Sunday, we would turn the booth to the wall so he couldn't get out. I mean, didn't he know we were there? We would take eggs to church on Sunday that we would decorate them like Easter eggs, except we wouldn't boil them. And we'd give them to the people who were meanest to us. You know, we said, "We brought you a present this morning, Mrs. Hamilton," and she would take the present and hold it up, and the thing would just go down in front of her. And she'd be so angry. And my mother would say, "They're just mischievous. They don't mean any harm. You know, they just don't." We were not disciplined. We were not disciplined as children. Other kids I can remember having to go in the house and do their homework and stuff like that, and I used to feel so sorry for them. You know, I slept with the books under my pillow. I mean, that was my way of studying. And these other kids, I mean, I just couldn't understand why they had to go in the house when we just ran around. You know, we were on our porch. We couldn't go a long distance, but we could be up as late as we wanted to be. That's just the way it was. By the time I came along, I think my mother was just exhausted. She was just exhausted, and I never learned how to do anything. I remember my brothers and sisters had chores, and they paid me not to do chores because I did them so badly. And I did them so badly on purpose because I was just what you call a free spirit out here. Now, I also was a very troubled child because since my mother had all these children, her father had come to live with her, and he took care of me. And my grandfather sexually abused me as I was a little girl, and I grew up feeling different and dirty. I remember on a Sunday morning, I would rush down the aisle every Sunday morning and join church. Every Sunday morning. Every Sunday morning, I would be there with tears running down my eyes, asking God to clean me up, you know. And little children aren't dirty. But that's how I felt about me. Then I had these wonderful brothers my brothers were just wonderful. I came out here in 1990 to bury my brother who pastored a church in Sacramento. He died of the disease of our family. Our family are all compulsive eaters, and his bowels had just burst from eating so much, you know. And we came out here to bury him. But in his youth, he was such a dynamic young man. And he was so full of, I just loved him. He wanted to be an actor, but you can't be an actor if you're born in a parsonage, you know. So he was the next best thing. He was going to be a minister. Very close. And I used to love to hear him preach. My mother used to say that my brother needed people in the pews to have dictionaries instead of the Bible because my brother used these long words, and I was so impressed by him. He used to say to me, too, "Dawn, you can't ever ride in a car with me unless you ride in the back seat, because you look so bad, I don't want anybody to ever think you're my girlfriend. No. But I didn't mind. I didn't mind because I was with my brother. Then I had this other brother who I thought was wonderful. He wanted to be a jazz player. But you can't be a jazz player if you're born in the parsonage. And so he would play these beautiful hymns, and we would all stand around the piano. What a wonderful family. And we'd sing these great hymns of the church, and we'd sound just like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And my dad would leave, and then we'd break into the blues. You know, and we'd sing jazz, and we'd really get down. And Dad would come back, and we'd switch right back to those. You know, and my dad said, what devout children they are, you know. It was just a crazy house. It really, my oldest sister, who was my role model, she was, oh, I just always thought my oldest sister was just so beautiful. The thing about her was she was thin. And I thought anybody who was thin was beautiful. You know, so she was, I watched everything she did. The problem was she was schizophrenic, but they didn't have a name for it. You know, I mean, we didn't know that she was schizophrenic. We didn't take her to any doctors at that point. And she used to do strange things, like you never knew which voice was talking to her. You know, it was like, and sometimes I remember the night before she got married, but she was brilliant. She was really brilliant. She was always the star of this play, or she was, it was just magnificent to watch. She sang like an angel. It was just wonderful. But I remember the night she was going to get married, a boyfriend came to the house, her fiance, and she took all the luggage and just threw it down on his head. And I said to myself, I was this little kid, I said, isn't that romantic, you know? That's how you treat men. This is so romantic, you know? I just love my sister. Then I had this other sister who did nothing but watch us. We used to call her the Gestapo with bloomers because she was so mean. She was just mean. Well, I would be mean, too, if she had to watch these kids, because these kids were not what you call nice kids to watch, you know. I mean, we skated on the dining room table. I mean, that's just not what you do, you know. But I just loved my family, though. I loved them because my husband used to say that when he first met all of us, it was like everybody talked at the same time. We were just, you know, but nobody cared because we just all talked at the same time. And we understood. I mean, every once in a while we would pause because we had to eat. We all ate all the time, too. You know, in some families, you know, where there's alcoholism and that disease, in my family, there was compulsive eating. We ate from the time we got up till the time we went to bed. You know, I mean, that was just, my father used to say no matter what was going on, sometimes he'd come home in the middle of the day and say, Mother, we're changing the menu. We're going to have Thanksgiving dinner today. And it would be like in July. And we'd be so happy because we'd go through the whole thing. We'd have Thanksgiving dinner. You know, I mean, it was just great. I loved it. At church, you'd have these great services, and when the people would feel the Spirit, they'd be high on the Spirit of God, and what they would do is go down to the church basement and stuff themselves. I was right there with them. I was this great, big, fat, obese child, happily stuffing myself on a daily basis. But I also did that because food stopped the pain. Food worked for me like a drug. You know, if you fill me up, enough. All these empty holes in me. All these places where I hurt would stop hurting. I'd just roll around with a stomach ache. You know? It didn't make much difference. You know? This low self-esteem. Always had this low self-esteem. Always felt nobody was really looking out for me. Poor me. I loved that play yesterday. I loved that play yesterday. But they'd hold up the sign and say, poor me. That was my nickname, poor me, you know. And I've always been dramatic anyway. So when I suffer, I've never suffered alone. I always believe taking a crowd with me, you know. Yeah. Love that play. When the woman had on the black, I used to wear a black, it was like a tent dress. It went out like this. So you could see that I really felt pain. Not just a little bit of pain. I felt pain. No. Just dramatic in all ways. My mother used to say sometimes, she's that the histrionic. All I hear from her is drama, drama, drama. I couldn't help it. That's who I was. I went from one extreme to the other. I was noisy or I couldn't say anything. If I was in a group of people I didn't know, I was real quiet. Never liked to go to parties because if I went to parties, I'd have to somehow or other do something, and I was too scared to do something. I lived in my own little head, my world. Grew up on movies, so it was always these little daydreams of mine that were going to work out. I always imagined who was going to be the one who was going to come and rescue me. I was looking for the rescuer. I never did find that rescuer. The rescuer came in the form of 12 steps, thank God. But I remember just, it was just a fascinating place to be. I remember that I discovered I could sing, and this was going to be my way of letting my parents know that I was there. Well, everybody could sing in my family, so this was no big deal, you know, but I started singing at churches, and people kind of telling me how wonderful I was. And I was really good. Now, my kids would kind of question that a little bit. They say she was average. I say I was good. Believe me, I'm the speaker. In their way back there in Chicago and Detroit, you know, and wherever they are. I remember getting all the solos, and I was so happy. This man who was a choir director, first time anybody ever paid attention to me, you know. And if you're a big, fat kid like I was, you want somebody to pay attention to you, you know. I always wanted somebody. I remember one time a boy came to the house, and I thought he had come to see me, and he asked for me, and my dad said, I don't like his looks. He can't come here, because we were not allowed to date until we were 18. And my brother said, who cares what he looks like? He's coming to see Dawn. You know, let him in. You know? But I was so anxious for somebody to pay attention to me, and this choir director paid attention to me. And it just made me feel like I was okay. Always looking for something on the outside to make me feel like I'm okay. You know, never the turmoil inside, just make me look good on the outside. And that's what I looked like. I thought I was okay because somebody paid attention to me. And I remember I got a ride home with him from church one choir rehearsal night. And this man took advantage of me. And I was so frightened. I remember going in the house and I wanted to tell my mother. You don't talk about those things in parsonages. And you don't talk about those things. By this time my father had become a bishop in the Methodist Church, and we don't talk about stuff like that in our house. And I remember we went to Europe that summer, and I just kept getting bigger and bigger. But nobody paid any attention to me because I was always big, you know. And I remember when we came home from Europe that summer, I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know who to tell. And so I just kept my secret, and I remember 9 months from the time we came back home. And I went to Women's Hospital in Detroit, Michigan, and stood at the admissions desk, and I said, I'm in trouble. I've been in labor for 2 days, and I don't know what to do. I don't have a doctor. I've never seen a doctor. And this man was standing next to me, and he said, I don't know who she is, but she's my patient. And I delivered a 10-pound, 4-ounce baby boy, and he was beautiful. He had all his little fingers and all his toes. And he was just a wonderful baby. And I was so grateful. I was so grateful because I was going to be a mother to this child. I was going to give this child all the attention I thought I had missed, you know. And my mother and father, I just can't imagine today what it must have been like for them to call my mother and father and say, well, by the way, you know, your daughter's at the hospital. She's just given birth to a child. But my mother and father came to the hospital, and they just stood there. And Dad said, we won't talk about it. We'll just put this behind you and we'll just move on. And I remember we got in the car going home from the hospital, and I had this baby in my arms, and we stopped at a stoplight, and someone opened the door of the car and took the baby out of my arms, and they closed the door of the car, and we drove home. My dad said, you have embarrassed me. My dad said, I'm a bishop of the church. I've lived an exemplary life before you. My dad said, for me to get myself together, go back to school, make something of myself. And I remember screaming and crying, and I remember going from church to church looking to see if I saw a baby that's hair grew just like my baby. I looked and looked for that child. And then one day, maybe a year later, I don't know what the time schedule was then, one day I woke up and I said, you know, the only thing wrong with me is I'm fat, always looking at the outside. And I said, if I can take care of the outside of me, everything will be all right. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to lose weight, and then I'm going to find a husband. Sounds like that would work. You know? And so I went to this diet doctor. Diet doctor had his office over a junk shop. I remember the cab driver said, young lady, I wouldn't take my dog to that doctor. And I said, neither would I. I'm going. You know? So I went to this diet doctor, and he gave me shots and pills. And I was a total maniac, you know, just crazy. But I lost weight. I mean, a year from that time, I walked out on my front porch. And I didn't look good. I mean, I was a fox. I'm telling you. I was looking good. I was looking great that summer. I was really looking. Now, I knew this wasn't going to last long. Because food was looming over here calling my name, saying, Dawn, I want you back, you know. But nevertheless, for the moment, I was starring. I mean, my brother said, you can ride in the front seat. Now, you know, I was looking good. Yeah. I remember this young man came to my house and pastored a church in Pontiac, Michigan, and he said, I had fallen in love with you. Truthfully, you had fallen in love with the outside of me. He didn't know anything about this crazy Dawn inside. He said, I've fallen in love with you, and will you marry me? And I said, yeah. Then there was this other young man who he was working for the government. He was a fine young man, you know, and he came up to me and he said, Dawn, will you marry me? And I said, yes. Then there was this young man who just come home from the service. And he was kind of spacey. I mean, like, he talked Martian. I remember he didn't have a job, which I thought was very unique. I thought that was very interesting, you know. But he was on the verge of getting a job. And he had his mustering out pay from the service. And he took me places I had never been in my life. He took me to places like bars. And we'd get to the bar, and people would open the doors of the bar, and they all knew his name. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, they knew his name. And some of them called him Dr. Crawford, and some of them called him, this is Mr. Crawford, who's an attorney. And some people said, and this is Mr. Crawford, who's, you know, always a nuclear physicist. This is Mr. Crawford, you know, who's an architect. I said, this guy is something. He is really unique, you know. He said to me, Dawn, there's something I want to tell you about myself. And I said, what is it, Peter? And he said, this is something really. He said, I'm an alcoholic. I said, isn't that romantic? You know, all your great thinkers are alcoholics. All the people that you know, the interesting people in the world are, isn't this something? Who do you think I married? Why am I standing before this podium? Why have I been in this program 38 years? Why do I keep coming back? We eloped. Now, I'd like to say that we eloped because it was just such a romantic thing to do. The truth of the matter is, we eloped because no way in the world could I have walked down that aisle in a white dress. Because I knew people would be pointing their finger at me and say, you know, she really is damaged material. You know, she had a child out of wedlock. You know that she also was sexually abused by her grandfather. She really shouldn't be walking down that aisle, and I knew I wouldn't be able to make it. Another reason was that my mother died the year before with cancer, and I remember my father saying to me, Dawn, I will never marry again. I have loved your mother, and I will never marry again. I thought that was such, what a deep, deep sense of love he had for my mother. You know, it was just a beautiful thing to see. Well, 6 weeks later, when Dad married, you know, didn't set so well with me, and I didn't want this lady helping out on anything that had to do with me. I remember going, she lived in Chicago, and I remember flying to Chicago and saying to her, you know, my dad is an old man, and you're an old woman, and you don't need this, and you're really marrying my dad to get his money. Now, when I think about it then, she was probably about 50, and my dad was about, couldn't have been over 54. What does that mean about me today? But I just assumed. I mean, I told my dad, you're through with it. You're over. I mean, you're over the hill. Why are you doing this to us? I wasn't doing this to us. He was marrying her. He suffered. I didn't. He married her. You know, I was kind of, I said, oh, my God, why are you doing this to us? And my dad, who always had a quaint way with words, said, listen, you're the only one who hurt your mother. Nothing I do is as bad as what you did. You broke her heart. So what could I say with that? What could I say? You know, what could I say? So we eloped, and we had this wonderful, never forget, I've been on this diet forever, and Peter had been not drinking, because being an alcoholic and drinking, he didn't want me to know what an alcoholic really was. So he would have like a drink when he went out, and then he'd take me home, and I don't know what he did after he took me home. But this night, I'll never forget, it was the most beautiful honeymoon night. I think I just should write a book about it. We went to the old Barlum Hotel in Detroit, Michigan, and I bought a bag full of pastrami sandwiches. And he bought a bag full of cheap German beer. And he drank beer all night, and I ate those sandwiches. I was so happy. I was so happy. I said, the diet is over. Excuse me. Excuse me, Donna's back. Peter said he left for work one day, and this slim, attractive woman was standing at the door. And he came home, and here I was. You know, I said, Chucky's home. Here I am, you know. The important thing was that I wanted him to love me. Not the outside of me. I wanted him to love Fat Dawn. That's who I was. I wanted him. Somebody had to love me. Now, interestingly enough, I didn't love myself. But somebody had to love me, you know, at my worst. I remember my kid said to me one time, she said, Mama, you know, Daddy must really love you. And I said, why do you say that, Alma? And she said, because every night you dress up just like Halloween. I had these rollers in my hair, you know. So he said, you dress just like Halloween, and Daddy still stays here. I said, thank you for sharing, Alma. Into this home, we brought these three children. I'm so grateful for those children. And I was an insane mother. They never knew who was going to be home, whether it was Dawn, who was eating and really happy, you know, and we could do anything. We could go and do all this stuff. Or if it was Dawn was starving herself because she was on a diet. And then all hell broke loose, you know. They would kind of peek in the door to see which mama was home. And they just never knew. But never, I didn't know either. I remember in upstate New York, one day I got a call on the telephone. My husband, by this time, had really developed into a man of substance. Now he didn't get fat. He was really, he always looked good. Always looked good. This drove me crazy. Always looked handsome. And I was this obese woman, and I remember somebody called me on the phone one day and said, you have a handsome husband. What are you going to do something about yourself? It just broke my heart, you know. I was so angry that I just went directly to the refrigerator and ate the rest of the morning. I mean, you know, it's like, oh, how could they say that to me? They didn't understand that I didn't want to look like this. I didn't want to look like this. I just didn't have any power over doing anything any different. You know, food loomed for me just like alcohol loomed for him. And poor Peter went to AA. I was glad he went to AA. He'd been out on one of his drunks where he had forgotten that he had a family, and I'd been home with no food in the house, and, you know, self-pity. And I could make, this is a great story, you know. He had left me at the hospital where the baby was born, forgot he left me there, and never did show up until about 5 days later. I'd call my dad and ask him for money to get out of the hospital. I was so angry. You know, I just had this rage inside me. But I didn't talk about the rage. I ate about it. You know what I mean? I just had this rage. It was all just stuffed down inside me, you know. And so, he called AA, and they came within, it seemed to me, within 2 hours and took Peter to a meeting. I'm so angry because I said, well, who's going to come and do something for me? I've been in this house for 3 days, and there's no food in the house. I want to know who's going to come and do something for me. And Peter went to AA, and he began really becoming Mr. AA in the first 90 days, you know. He was working the first and the 12th step, and he was a real sensation. Real sensation. Now, our home, we were at home on the verge of divorcing. I mean, we were just crazy. It was just awful. But nevertheless, he was Mr. AA, and I wanted to know what went on in those meetings, so I went to a few open meetings, and the thing that really bothered me was AA women kept calling my house. You know, I was so furious. They kept calling my house. And I was so afraid one of them was going to take my husband. Then I was also afraid they were going to leave him. You know, I know just which one would be the best. So I decided, I had this friend whose husband also went to AA, and we decided that what we should do is we should go to this program we heard about called Al-Anon. And I'd like you to think I went because I thought something was wrong with me. I was on the verge at this point of being martyred in the church. I was on the verge of being made a saint. Now, nobody told me that. I just knew that. You know what I mean? I could just tell it. The way I suffered, I mean, I ought to have been canonized. You know, it's just wonderful to see, you know. So we decided we would go to the Old Han and Y in Detroit, Michigan. And I remember sitting there for about, we'd go maybe three meetings, and then I had the whole program. I understood it from the beginning to the end, and I was ready to start my own meeting. So I started my own meeting, my friend and I. She was so brilliant. What her suggestion was that what we should do is that we should go to the meetings with our husband, or she would drive us one way or the other, and one of us would lay on the back, in the back seat of the car with a blanket over us, and we could tell whether our husbands went home with other women or something, you know, because he would come home so late from these meetings. I thought that was the most brilliant idea I ever heard in my life. So I asked her to be my sponsor. Now, Al-Anon was new then. We didn't have old-timers, you know. We had this one little blue book that we used to read, and I used to read that book diligently, and I'd look at all the areas that Peter needed help, and I'd underline all those areas, and then I would figure how I could help him with his program, you know. I'd read the big book, and I'd study all the places that I ought to just say out loud to him and help him grow so that he could become the kind of husband I deserved. Truthfully, he was the husband I deserved at that point in my life. You know, I wouldn't have known how to deal with somebody who was sane, because I was equally, we were soulmates together. Peter used to say that I can't live with you, but I can't live without you. You know, like, and I felt the same way. I couldn't really live with him, but I didn't know what to do without him. It was like, it was just insane. And these three children were brought into the house, you know? And I can remember some of our worst days were when my husband was in AA and I was in the beginning years of Al-Anon. You would hear my husband and I fighting one another, not physically, but verbally, just so angry with one another. And the kids would be in the closet hanging on to one another, wondering what was going to happen. I owe my kids so many amends. You know? I spent these last years giving them unconditional love. Unconditional love. Because they saw the worst of the program in the beginning. I used to take them to meetings with me, and my kids would hear me talk this wonderful talk in the meetings, and then I'd go home and be crazy again. You know? They'd be in the midst, they'd watch me, I'd be yelling at their father would be yelling at me, and the phone would ring, and I'd pick it up and say, "Hello? Is there anything I can do to help you?" I sponsored people, and the people I sponsored got better, while I got sicker. I mean, I was really what you call a loser. I think about that now, and I think about people coming in these rooms, and I want you to always remember, don't give up on people. We get well on our time schedule. It's between me and my higher power. Just listen, you know. Now, you don't have to say, "Will you lead a meeting? We know you're troubled." You know, I mean, I don't think that's a good thing. I think we ought to have a topic. You know, we ought to deal with the steps. But the truth of the matter is, it's none of our business. This program is open to anybody. I don't care how sick they seem to me or to you. I kept coming back, and that's the miracle. That's the miracle for me of this program. I was one of the slowest learners I've ever heard about in these rooms. But so what? I kept coming back, you know. And I'm here today because I kept coming back. I remember it's been about 21 years ago, my kids and I were in upstate New York. And I remember my husband had gone to a party that night, and he was looking nice, as usual. And I was between the green dress and the brown dress, which were stretch knits that I had gotten from Spiegel Catalog, you know. And I remember not being able to get in those dresses, and I felt I would look in the mirror and I'd say, "Oh, my God, you know, look what you've become. Look what you've become." And I remember my sponsor said to me, "Dawn, are you going to ever work those steps in your life?" And I said, "I can't right now. I'm working them for Peter. I'm working them, trying to make these kids be what they're supposed to be." And they had stopped wanting to shine for me. They had been my little, you know, like little puppets. "Do a dance. Sing. Do this. Do that." And they would do those things for me. And people would say, "Oh, how brilliant your children are. How gifted your children are." And then they started saying,
I don't want to do that, Mama. I don't want to entertain you anymore. I don't want to entertain anybody. I just want to be me. And my sponsor said, when are you going to work those steps? And I said, I don't know. My kids are in trouble. My husband's in trouble. My husband's not paying any attention even to my insanity. We are a sick family. But we looked good. You know, that's the danger. I used to call us the fig tree family. There's a fig tree story in the Bible about this fig tree that looks like it's in bloom and it looks like it has the figs on it, and the master goes up to pick a fig and the tree is barren. That's how I was, just barren. She said, when are you going to work those steps? And I said, but what about my kids? And she said, you know, when you're on the plane and they say that if turbulence comes, and if the oxygen mask falls out, put the oxygen mask on your face first and then put it on your children. Somebody you can help. And right now, the only person I see that needs help desperately is you. And I understood that I was powerless. I couldn't fix anybody. I worked so hard, had all these plans, you know. All you have to say is, Dawn, I need you, and I'm right there to fix you, you know. She said, you can't do that anymore. We're just going to work on Dawn. And I realized that I was powerless. That there's nothing I can fix, not people, not places, not situations, not my compulsive eating. None of those things can I fix, but that there is one who has all power. And I find him now. You know. And I got under new management. You know. I got under new management. And my life began to change. I began to tell my story, not where I used to begin it, like when I met the alcoholic. I went back and told my story, the history of who I was, where I came from, what it was like. And then I was willing to share it with another human being. This is who I am. Let me tell you who I am. Let me tell you about my anger and my resentments and my fears and my self-pity and my just being so locked into myself. Please let me tell you. And I told another human being. And the miracle was they didn't walk out on me. They just loved me through the process. And I began to understand how this program worked. And I looked at those character defects and I said, Lord, I can't do anything about it. I just can't. I don't know how to change me. I don't know how to stop being jealous of my husband. I was so jealous of that man. That man could stand and talk to somebody 80 years old, because that isn't too far from us now, but 80 years old. He's 70 now and I'm 65, so, you know, I used to say 80 and that was old. But, but he could start talking to somebody, and all at once, the jealousy would hit my feet and it would just come up, and there was nothing I could do about it, just nothing. I remember once we were at this party, and Peter was entertaining his staff, and it was just such a nice, they were just wonderful people. And he had said to me the day before, he said, Dawn, you know, I hired a new secretary. And I said, well, isn't that nice? And he said, yes, she's an older woman, and good, she's an older woman. I was very happy about it. So we were at this party, and all these people were milling around, talking, and so forth. And here came this young woman in a miniskirt up to me and said, Mrs. Crawford, I'm your husband's new secretary. Well, I felt this rage hit my feet, this anger hit my feet, and my husband was coming over saying, she didn't look like that when I hired her. I don't know what happened overnight, you know. And he got me out of there. I mean, he got me out of there quick. And all the way home, I was telling him, I was arguing, I was so mad, I was accusing him of everything, and he stopped and he said, Dawn, do you think it might have something to do with your low self-esteem? And I was furious because he hit on a truth. If you hit on a truth, I don't know how to handle it at that point in my life in any other way but to get angry. And I remember getting on my knees when I got home and saying, God, look, I just can't handle this anymore. I am miserable everywhere I go. You know, I don't even want to go anyplace with him, because if he looks like he's looking out the side of the window, I'm saying, who are you looking at? You know what I mean? Just kind of, and if I'm not saying it, I'm thinking it. And I'm saying, well, I would look out that window too if I looked like I look. You know, it was just that awful, awful, low self-esteem. And I remember getting on my knees and saying, God, I can't handle this anymore. I just can't handle it. And we were out at a retreat, maybe about 3 or 4 weeks later, and Peter was standing over in the corner talking to some women. And I looked over there, and all I felt in my heart was love for Peter. I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that. Only this higher power that I found in these rooms was capable of getting inside me and changing me. You know, I started becoming a loving human being. You know? I started, just as my husband says, he's tired of hearing me say that, I just want to be a nice person. You know what I mean? Just a nice person. Don't want to be exceptional. Don't want to be a star. Don't want to be any of those things. I just want to be a nice person who can meet people in my life with love. And that's what happened as I began working those steps. And then I remembered I had to start making amends. Well, Lisa, a couple years before, had come to me and said, Mama, there's something I ought to tell you about myself. And I was ready. I was going to be to her all those things my parents had never been able to be to me. You know, I was going to be a mother superior. You know, I was going to be this great mother. My daughter said, you know, Mama, she said, I'm a lesbian. And I said, not in my house, you are. And I lost my daughter for a while, you know. Lost her for a while. She would call from California sometimes. She'd call from Boise, Idaho. She'd call from Philadelphia. She'd call from so many places. And sometimes we'd cry on the phone together. But I lost her for a while. And then as I began to work these steps in my life on a daily basis, the telephone rang one day, and it was my daughter, Lisa. And she said, Mom, I want to come home. I'm suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And she said, I want to bring my friend with me, my partner. And I remember my sponsor had said, Dawn, read page 449 of the big book. Read it every day of your life. Read it and all the way to the end. Read it until God changes you. Read it until you can accept whoever comes into your life. Read it so that you understand if there's something wrong with the way you feel about somebody, you need to look at you. And I said to Lisa, come on home. And Lisa came home. That was over 15 years ago. And she and her friend Nancy went to AA. And we have been with them as they celebrated their 15 years of sobriety in these rooms. We've been to two internationals with Lisa and Nancy. I love them with all my heart. They didn't have to change. God changed me and opened my heart to say, you are made in the image of God. What would the Master do? The Master would say, come unto me. Come on, kids. And we have such a great relationship. Then I have this girl, Alma. I used to say, Lord, please, my mother used to say, I want you to have a child that's just like you. I wouldn't wish that on anybody, you know. But I had Alma. Alma was the one who said, you know, I dressed up like Halloween for a dad. Alma was the one who used to say when I would spank her on her butt, Alma would say, it's too bad that a big lady like you has to hit a little girl like me. That's my Alma. That Alma's always been wonderful. I remember Alma one time, Lisa had been singing at a church, and everybody had given Lisa all these accolations and said, oh, what a wonderful job he did. Alma was so furious. She was about 2 and a half, and she was sitting in the back of the church, and she jumped up from the pew and ran to the front of the church and pulled down her pants and mooned the congregation. That's my girl. That's my Alma. Alma is something. Alma could have me on the verge of tears at any given moment, you know. But thank God the best thing we have in our home is a sense of humor. And I would just sit there and say, I don't believe this little kid is reducing me to this, you know. One thing I like about my program today, all the women I sponsor, none of them hit their children. They call me and yell at me. And then they figure out another way that they can deal with those children on a one-to-one basis. You know, they don't snatch them around like I used to snatch them around. They hear the way I tell them what my behavior used to be, and they don't do that, you know. But Alma just was a challenge from the time she was born. I just love that little girl. Love all of them, but she's just been such a challenge. I can remember the other kids would be lined up saying, please, Alma, tell them you did it because we'll all be in trouble. And Alma said, are you kidding? I'm not telling anything. She still apologizes to her brother and sister, you know, for her behavior. But, oh, Alma, I remember when she went away to college. I remember she didn't want to go to this college that we could afford to send her to. Because in this program, with us both working recovery, we were really doing great then, really doing great. And my husband and I, we moved to the Washington area because he was going to work in the Carter administration dealing with the health care program. And they didn't have a health care program. So my husband ended up out of work. And he was out of work for 2 years. We lost everything. Everything. We lost our beautiful home. And this is in sobriety. This was in real, in recovery. This was not supposed to happen. This is not the way the book read as far as I was concerned. But you know what? God stripped those things from us and we became better people. You know? Oh, we became nicer people. You know? We didn't care as much about what we looked like. We cared about what God was doing on the inside. And for 2 years, we just didn't have any money. And then I went to work so we could get Alma to college because we had promised her a college degree. And Alma said she had decided she, at first, she wanted to go to, we were going to send her to Virginia, UVA, and she decided she wouldn't want to go there. She wanted to go to this woman's college. Well, this woman's college was extremely expensive. But that was okay. We were going to do our best to send Alma there. All the money I made, we saved for Alma to go to college. And I remember on her way home from she was in Washington one Sunday, and she was coming home, and a man put a knife in Alma's neck and dragged Alma off into an alley and raped my child. And she was so broken for a while. And I'm so grateful for these rooms because I had worked through my stuff, you know. And I could go and sit with Alma and just love her. You know, I could let her tell me about her problem, what had happened, the fear that were part of her, and I could just love her. I didn't have to bring my stuff into her area, you know. I didn't have to hurt because she hurt. I could say, I'm doing okay right now. My baby's hurting. Let me hold her, you know, and I could be there for her. Well, then Alma decided she was going to go back to school, and I was so grateful. So she went to Trinity, and then she decided, this is Alma. She said that she'd come home one day and she said, I know what I'm going to do with my life. I know what I'm going to do. I'm quitting school today. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to become a waitress. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a waitress. It was just that Peter said, I'm on my way to my meeting. And I said, I'm on my way to my meeting. You know? My sponsor said, just let her go, you know. So I remember going to the restaurant where Alma was waiting tables, and I have never seen such a terrible waitress in my life. I mean, I ordered one thing, and she brought another, and she said, eat it. It's better than what you ordered, you know. The man at the table next to us said, this is the worst waitress I have ever had in my life. Alma said, well, sue me. You know? She said, if you want better food, go to a better restaurant. You know what I mean? It was... Then one day she came home from school and said, I'm going back to school. She said, I keep feeling this call. And so she went away and she finished up her undergraduate degree at Trinity. And then she went away to Boston and studied for a year at the Women's Episcopal Seminary. And then she came home and went to Howard and finished her, got her master's in divinity. And I remember it's been 4 years ago now that Alma walked down the aisle and was ordained in the United Church of Christ, and she's also been ordained in the Unitarian Church, and she pastors a church in Chicago. For people who are on the outside and the fringes of life, Alma came to me a couple of years ago and said, "There's Mama, there's something I want to tell you about myself. I'm gay. I had two gay daughters then." And I said, "Wow, Alma, whatever it is, you're my girl, you know? Alma is blessed. She's made in the image of God." And I was there with her on Pentecost Sunday. And we watched the miracle of Pentecost as she preached. Alma's most eloquent preacher, other than my dad, I've ever heard in my life. I just love to hear her. I sit at the feet of my children now. And they teach me about life. Lisa works a program that's so strong that I sit and listen to her, and she tells, who would have thought that this change would happen? I sit at the feet of them, and they teach me about love They teach me about acceptance. I love these children so much. The gift that God... I heard my daughter say to her congregation one Sunday, you know, if my mother can get well, anybody can. But what a gift, isn't that? I choose to take it as a compliment. And then David. David was my heart. He was so precious. He was such a cute little boy. And I remember David... David just wanted to be David. And he was in this house with these domineering sisters. And I remember, poor thing, I mean, you never knew what he was going to come up with because he had to survive there. I used to think Alma was going to kill him at any given moment, you know, because she never liked him. She didn't like him because he was sick a lot. He had bronchitis awful a lot. And she used to say, well, you know, he gets all this attention because he's sick, you know. And I used to always be afraid. She'd say, David, do you want a nut? And he's allergic to nuts. If you ate a nut, he would swell up, you know. And she'd say, oh, I put a little nuts in that. Can we share it with David? You know, I said, Alma, you can't do that. Alma's still apologizing. Alma, you can't do that to David. And I remember when David was, when he went through his depression and he got real sick and we had to put him in the hospital for a while. And I thought, David, he had tried to kill himself. And I remember just trying to figure out, what do we do now? And my sponsor said, you live your program. You live your program, and then you just be there for David. And I remember my husband and I going to the hospital and just sitting with David and loving him through the process. And about 5 years ago, David was in a bar. Where else would one of our children be? He was in a bar, and he called. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And he said, Mama, I think I've just experienced one of your miracles. And I said, what happened, David? He said, this man came out of the stall. And I had just said out loud, I'm so drunk, I don't know what my name is. And the man said, you don't have to live like that, son. He said, I'll take you to a meeting. God met my son in the men's room of a bar. You know? I had let go of him. I had put him in God's hands. I had said, do with him what you will. Just help me to be a loving, accepting human being of whatever it is. And God met my son in a bar. What an extravagant God I serve, you know, that I found in these rooms. I let people go and they begin to get well. You know, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. It really is. About 15 years ago, I was sitting around my sister's table and she was just, she thought she was dying. She wanted me to know her secret. You know, we really are as sick as our secrets. We keep these things buried in us. And if you don't have 12-step programs, you just burden yourself down with so much. You know, I think sometimes of the weight I carried wasn't just the physical weight. It was the weights of the world, you know. And my sister said, this boy that I adopted when he was 2 years old, this is your son. And I was reunited with my baby, you know. My baby was a grown man by then. He was a fine young man. And I was just with him about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And I've been with him quite often. And I have two beautiful grandchildren by this young man. And just such a miracle, you know. He thinks I'm great. He thinks we're weird because we're all in 12-step programs. But, you know, he should have seen us before. You know, if you come to my house in a short amount of time, we're going to have a meeting. That's just the way it is. My kids bring their friends. Ah, by the way, I didn't tell you about David. David came to me and he said, there's something I ought to tell you about myself. I have three gay children. I am so blessed. We have meetings, you know, they bring the people to my house that a lot of time people close them out, you know. But in my house, they know that I'm going to love them unconditionally because they are who they are. I mean, my kids didn't wake up every morning and say, well, let me think. Today I think I'll be black and I'm going to have a whole lot of prejudice because I'm black. I'm going to also be gay. Now, that ought to really fix them. I mean, that wasn't like, you know, that wasn't a choice. That wasn't a choice. I sometimes think it might be genetic. I don't know what causes gay children. You know, I don't know that. But I do know that they are wonderful human beings. And they're mine and my husband's, and we love them completely. Completely, you know. So now I've got this other son back. My life is just going great. It's just a wonderful. Peter's finally gone back to work. We've worked long enough, and now I've retired and he's retired, and We've been able to work through the amends we've made to people. I look at my parents now, and I thank my dad. You know, he did all the only way he knew how to do. He took that child out of me. I thought I'd be a wonderful mother, but I would have been a smothering mother. I mean, I didn't know at that point how to love a child completely and give it unconditional. The boy is better that he didn't have me, but he has me now. And that's the good news. My sister's still his mother. She's been a wonderful mother to that boy, you know. But he also calls me mom, and I love that too, you know. God has been so rich, you know. And that grandfather that sexually abused me. I had all this rage and anger towards him, you know. And then I began to look at his life and realize that he had been a slave. He'd been brutalized all his life. I mean, that's just who he was, you know. And I had to work through that process until I could come on the other side and say, well, I forgive you. Not yet. I mean, I think that's terrible. People who abuse children ought to be dealt with. But by the same token, he still is my grandpa and I love him today, you know. Only through the steps. Only through the steps, you know. It's a miracle. Peter and I are best friends today, as well as lovers. You know, who would have thought that? Who would have thought that? We just have the best. We call our bedroom junk heaven. Because I got my books on my side, and he's got his books on his side, and I'm reading, and I throw a book over to him, and he's reading, and he throws a book over to me. We just have a great time. God has restored this marriage like it. People think we're the ideal couple until they hear us speak. What a miracle. What a miracle. You know, I've thought about that. George is my oldest son, his biological father. You know, what a terrible thing he did to me as a young woman. But you know what? It says in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we will not regret the past nor wish to close the door. If it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't have these two grandchildren. No. I don't understand. I don't understand. But today I say thank you for that experience. You know, I don't understand what changed the inside of me so that I could become a person who's full of gratitude as opposed to a person who's full of self-pity and hate. All I know is I kept coming back. And I began to work this program in my life, and I began to try to live this program on a daily basis. There's a story. It says in a line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that some of us have picked up our beds and walked. And that story comes from a story in the Bible about this man who sat by the roadside for some 38 years. And all he had to do was get up and get into the pond. And if he got into the pond, he would be made whole. But he sat by the roadside, you know. It was kind of like me sitting in those Al-Anon meetings, you know, just flipping over, you know. Just insane. Sitting there, you know. And other people were working the steps and other people were doing things to change their lives. And I'm just sitting there, totally confused, just out of it. Just in insanity. But in this story in the Bible, it says one day the man named Jesus came by and said to this man, do you want to be well? Yeah. And this man had all the excuses that I probably have. Like, I mean, I don't necessarily want to give up self-pity or resentment or anger. Because as bad as they are, or depression, because they do work for me. You know, I mean, I get a lot of attention. I get a lot of attention doing this stuff, you know. But the master asked this man, do you want to be well? And the man finally said, yes, yes. And then see, if I was Jesus, here's what I would have done. I'd have reached over there and I'd touched him and I'd say, you are now made whole. But that's not what he did. That's not what he did. See, that was too easy a process. That's like when I used to lay on the sofa weighing 250 pounds and I'd say, please God, make me thin. If you make me thin, let's strike me and make me thin, I'll serve you the rest of my life. You know, it's like, I didn't want to go through any process, you know. But Jesus said, take up your bed and walk. My sponsor said, Dawn, how long is it going to be before you work those steps? How long is it going to be? She said, take up your bed, which are those 12 suggested steps, and walk. I don't know where you are in your program. I don't know what is the thing that keeps you from totally surrendering. I don't know what it is if you think you suffer from terminal uniqueness. I don't know what it is, you know. But the good news is that the fact that we're here, this Sunday morning, in this place, God means for you to be well. And the journey is so rich if you'll surrender. The journey is so full of miracles. They just happen if you surrender. So don't give up on yourself or anybody else. Just keep coming back. Pardon from sin and a peace that endureth. Thine own dear presence to lead and to guide. Faith for today and bright hope for tomorrow. Blessings are mine and 10,000 beside. Great is thy faithfulness. Great is thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. All I have needed, not wanted, all I have needed, God's hand has provided. Great is his faithfulness to me. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.